Rabbi Beryl Wine's lectures at 1-800-499-WEIN, 1-800-499-WEIN, or rabbiwine.com, rabbiwein.com. We move now to Rabbi Beryl Wine's discussion on an overview of kinnis. We'll say kinnis tonight after Eicha. We'll say kinnis tomorrow morning, of course. Many of us together here at JM and the AM will be tuned in. Here is the overview of kinnis at JM in the AM.
Today and tomorrow I'm going to discuss with you the keynote, the poetry, the elegies that are said on Tisha B'Av. So today I want to give you a general understanding and who the authors are. And tomorrow we will spend some time on the actual keynote themselves. The original keynote is naturally the Book of Eicha, of which the Novi Yirmiyahu composed. And the word keynote is found in the Novi, in Yirmiyahu. And the keynote was a form of mourning. It was accepted in the ancient world and in even in the medieval world that there were professional mourners. That the family, God forbid, a funeral took place, would hire professional mourners, usually women, that would come and weep. And in so doing, they would inspire others to that emotion as well. The Novi says, Kiru lamkononot, call the weepers, call in the professional mourners. So to us that's a little bizarre, because we're not into weeping that much anyway. In the Western world it is no longer macho to weep. Therefore, these events, such as a funeral, God forbid, are oftentimes very sterile, unemotional. Let's get it over with. But in the ancient world, and I mentioned to you, even in the medieval world, it was an event. Not just an event for the family that was directly involved, but it was an event for everyone. And because of that, therefore, this was an honored profession to be a professional weeper. Later in Jewish life, there were professional eulogy sayers who would be maspid, who would say the hesped. And that was their forte, so to speak. And there's an entire literature of hespedim, of eulogies. Now again, it has changed so in this world that I barely recognize. But for instance, in my youth, if there was a funeral, God forbid, no member of the family would get up to speak. The ones that spoke were always outside the family. Rabbis, teachers, communal people. But it was unheard of that, for instance, a son or a daughter should speak at a funeral regarding a deceased parent. But that has turned around 180 degrees today, where it's de rigueur, it's the accepted practice. So in these matters, things change. So what was once bizarre, or rather what was once normal may appear to us today to be bizarre, and what we think is normal would perhaps appear to be bizarre to them. So you had these people that said keynote. Now, in Jewish life, the expression of poetry found an outlet basically in religious life, though there was an outlet in secular poetry as well. And in two areas was poetry emphasized. One was the keynote that we're going to discuss that has to do with Tisha B'Av, and the other has to do with ritual poetry such as Slichot, which exist before the Yom Noroim, or prayers in the middle of the prayer service, which were called Yotzrot. And I'll try and discuss a little of that as well. But that's where poetry was concentrated. And during the Golden Age of Spain, so then there was a great deal of secular poetry also, written by great men, because it was the spirit of the times. The Spanish world that they lived in was a world of poems. And for instance, if you went to visit somebody, so today we bring a bottle of wine or candy or something, then they brought a poem. And if you went to a funeral, God forbid, so then you brought a poem, which was a eulogy, or for the house of the person who was mourning. And everybody tried their hand at poetry. Some were very great at it. We also have a form of poetry that we call Zmirot, that we sing at the Sabbath meals. For instance, there's a great poem, Yonah Motza Bo Manoach V'Shom Yanucha Bo Yigiei Koach. So that Zemer was written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who lived in the 12th century, and to a great extent he is the poet laureate of the Jewish people. But he wrote that poem for a Sheva Brachot on Shabbat, between a kala named a chatan named Yonah and a kala named Menucha, and it's a play on Shabbat and on the Sheva Brachot, right? Yonah, the chosan, found Menucha, found Manoah, and Yonah also means it's the symbol of the Jewish people, and Manoah is the symbol of Shabbat. So it's that play on words, and they, so he gave it as a present for the Sheva Brachot, but it became so popular and well accepted that everybody sings it today. So we live in a world that's pretty dry, you know, our world is pretty gray, there's not much of a flash of color to it. But it wasn't always that way in the Jewish world. And poetry was an accepted form of art, creativity. And as I mentioned, almost everybody tried their hand at it. For instance, we have the Slichot from Rashi that we recite Erev Rosh Hashanah. Rashi felt impelled somehow to write a poem because of the fact that everybody was writing poems. The earliest poet is a man called Rabbi Elozer HaKalir. In fact, over half of the keynote that we're going to recite on Tisha B'Av were written by him. He is the most prolific of the poets. And he wrote Yotzrot for every Shabbos of the year, every Shabbat of the year, every Parsha, and for every holiday. We recite many of his poems in our Mahzor for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The structure of the poem is as follows. The structure of how it is, it's called Yotzrot, but because the first place where they introduced, I think, because it's a question in halacha, whether you can say a poem in the middle of davening, right? Whether or not that's a hefsek. Today, because of the opposition of the Gaon of Vilna, mainly, to the introduction of poems in the middle of davening, So the audience for poetry in the middle of davening has been diminished. But there was a time in the Jewish world where everybody said Yotzot and everybody said the Piyutim, and the more the merrier, and especially on Yom Kippur when you had nothing to do all day. So then they put in all the poems that they could. So it's called Yotzrot because it was introduced in the Bracha, Baruch Ato Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Yotzeror, Uvorei Choshe, Chosei Sholom, Uvorei Sakol. So after that Bracha, they inserted poems. So those poems were called Yotzrot after the word Yotzer. Then there were poems that were called Zulat because of the fact that they were introduced in the middle of the Kedusha, Kodosh, Kodosh, Kodosh. Then there were poems that were called Geula, because they were introduced in the middle of the Bracha, Goal Yisrael. And then in the repetition of the Shmona Esrei, we had things that were called Krovot, the near poems, which were right in the beginning, and then poems in Kedusha. So today, they almost universally, no one recites poems in Kedusha anymore. But if you have an old Mauser, old European Mauser to look at, you'll see that there are long passages to be said in the middle of Kedusha, poems that were recited. So that became common. That became that accepted. And the poems were religious in nature. As I mentioned, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is the most prolific of all of them. There was another Babylonian poet by the name of Yanai, Piyute Yanai, the poems of Yanai, but those poems are only recited in certain communities in the world. They never achieved the popularity that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir did. Now, who was Rabbi Elazar HaKalir? So, like, all things in the Jewish world, there are different opinions. Tosfos mentions that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir was the Tana of Rabbi Elazar Reb Shimon, the son of Reb Shimon ben Yochai, which would date him very early, date him back to the second century before the second century after the Common Era. And also would give him a stature of being a Tana. However, most of the other scholars and commentators say that Rabbi Elazar HaKalir is not the Tana, Rabbi Elazar Reb Shimon, but rather he is a Babylonian or Balkan Jew who lived in probably the 7th or 8th century, and wrote those poems. Now, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir takes great liberty with the Hebrew language. The Hebrew language, as you know, is a very sparse language. It has a very small base of vocabulary. That's why, for instance, in modern Hebrew, we have to import so many words, because the language is, English, for instance, is an enormously rich language in terms of words and synonyms. But Hebrew is very tight, very small based. So what he did is he took nouns and he made them into verbs. Took verbs and made them into nouns. He has a famous statement of one of his poems, Ha'admon Kibot. Now that's we say that on Yom Kippur, this poem. Ha'admon, the red one, meaning Esav, Kibot. When he looked to see Yaakov's family and his wives and his children attempted to give them the evil eye, so to speak. Now, so the Admon is an invention of his. Bot is certainly an invention of his. No Hebrew word, bot. But because of the poetic structure, he, to keep the meter, to keep the rhyme, so he took liberties with the language. Because of the fact that he took liberties with the language, Rabbeinu Avrom ibn Ezra, who was a poet in his own right, and a critic, in his commentary to Koheles, towards the end of the fourth chapter, beginning of the fifth chapter, or maybe it's towards the end of the fifth chapter, he takes on Rav Elazar HaKalir head on. And he says, really, very negative things about his poetry, how he took those liberties with the old language. But history voted for Rav Elazar HaKalir. The Jewish people took his poems and inserted them everywhere in their ritual service. And therefore, in the Book of Kinot, which has, I think, 52 poems, there are 27 or 28 are from him. The first 21 in a row are his. And the style of the poems is to take verses from the Book of Eicha itself, and to build a poem, that, in other words, the verse becomes the refrain in the poem. Now, Rav Elazar HaKalir was a master of knowing Talmud and Midrash, so therefore you have to be a Lamdan to be able to figure out his poem. And it's not easy to do so. And in fact, there are certain riddles in his poems that have remained unsolved until today. Just as there is a famous riddle, that's another thing that was in the Jewish world, is that people wrote riddles, and you have to figure it out. So there's a riddle in the introduction of the Eben Ezra, the Chumash Breishis, that for the last 1,000 years almost, people are trying to figure out what the answer to the riddle is, and no one has ever come up with the answer yet. It's like that math problem. What? There's a famous math problem for which no one, there's a prize of millions of dollars if you can figure out the. There's more money if you can figure out where Saddam Hussein is, but the, but there is a prize for solving this math problem. So there are riddles, you know. So again, it looks to us bizarre. I mean, you know, none of our scholars today occupy themselves with such things. But again, in the Middle Ages and the pre-Middle Ages, this was common. It was intellectual exercise. It was the spirit of the times. And the Jews always were swayed by whatever the spirit of the times was, at least culturally. So you have here this bulk of Kinos of Rav Elazar HaKalir. The bulk of Kinos is built upon the Book of Eicha, and almost every Kino uses a verse from Eicha as being a refrain, a base for the poetry that follows. Now, what's interesting in the keynote is that the expression of sorrow is always intense and personal. It's almost written in first person, second person. It's not something that happened to Jewish people, it's something that happened to me. And that is how the author portrays it. That's how the poet portrays it. Because we all know that we somehow are able to be sanguine about other people's troubles, God forbid. But if God forbid we have troubles, so then we're a little more focused. That's what they say, you know, the difference between minor surgery and major surgery is that if it's you, it's minor surgery, and if it's me, it's major surgery. In the keynote, the day of Tisha B'Av has been a sad day for the Jewish people, generally. The first Tisha B'Av was in the desert in when they left Egypt, when the Meraglim came back, the spies came back and gave the negative report regarding the land of Israel. So it says, Vayivku balayla ahu, and that night did the Jewish people weep. They said, Odo anachno holchim, where are you taking us? We're going to die. Our enemies will overwhelm us. It's suicidal for us to go to Israel. You took us out of Egypt to die here in the desert. So they wept. So the Medrash says, the famous Medrash, you weep tonight really for no reason, but I will give you reason throughout history to weep on this night. So the first Tisha B'Av is in the desert. The first temple is destroyed on the 9th of Av. The second temple began burning in the late afternoon of the 9th of Av and burned throughout the 10th of Av. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan said that I would have decreed to fast on the 10th of Av. But that would have been asking too much of the people to have to fast 2 days consecutively. And since the 9th of Av was established already, so we fast on the 9th of Av because the beginning of the Churban is the 9th of Av. The city of Beitar, which was the last stronghold of Bar Kokhba and his rebellion, fell on Tisha B'Av to the Romans in the year 139. And that marked the end of the rebellion. The Romans slaughtered the inhabitants of the city. So the 9th of Av has always been a black letter day on the Jewish calendar. In 1492, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, the last days to leave, fell on the 9th of Av. It's interesting, Columbus attempted to set sail for the New World on the 9th of Av. But he was unable to clear the harbor because of the mass of ships carrying Jews away. So he had to wait till the traffic, the harbor master would allow him to go. Just as an aside, Columbus's voyage was financed by Jews. Abraham Señor was one of the wealthiest Jews in Spain. So there's an irony in the 9th of Av, at least as far as the Jewish people are concerned. Because when he set sail 511 years ago, no one imagined that continent and the country that he would discover would one day be a haven for the Jewish people in another time of terrible events. First World War began its hostilities around the 9th of Av. It was never a good time for us. Therefore, in the keynote are poems, elegies, weeping about other events than the destruction of the temple itself. There is a long poem written about the Crusades, the destruction of the Jewish communities of the Spires and Worms and Mainz in 1096 by the First Crusade. There is a long poem written by the Maharam of Rutenberg, the mayor of Rutenberg, who is the teacher and rebbe of the Rosh, of Rabbeinu Osher, one of the great men of Ashkenazic Jewry, regarding the fact that the king of France, Louis the Ninth, in 1240, burned all of the copies of the Talmud that were extant in France in the courtyard of the Louvre, you know, where the new pyramid is today, the new museum of the Louvre. So right there is where all of the books of the Talmud scrolls were gathered and burned. That really marked the end of Jewish France, and then the Jews were expelled. And all the yeshivas closed, and they had the balitosis, etc., and they moved east to Germany and Bohemia and eventually to Poland. And the story about the burning of the books is also instructive because it speaks to zealotry, which is a very combustible, volatile emotion in the Jewish world. After the Rambam died, there were those who objected strongly to ideas and works that he had written. And they objected to the Sefer Hamada.
WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WNYX Montgomery.
Which is the first section of the Yoda Chazoka, the Mishnah Torah, because of its philosophic, rational bent. And they objected to the things that he said in the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. And there raged a cultural war for about 150 years regarding the books of the Rambam. The Rambam's greatest defenders lived in Provence, in southern France, and his greatest detractors lived in Provence. And as unfortunately usually happens, when it comes to matters such as this, banning books, disagreeing with people, calling other people an apokoros, so things get out of hand. Not only to get out of hand, then it becomes almost a religious duty to be an idiot. And what happened was that certain zealots went to the church and informed the church that the books of the Rambam were strongly anti-Christian. Not only anti-Christian, but that they were insulting and mocking to Christianity. And the church therefore ordered that the books of the Rambam be burned. In Montpellier and other places in Provence. And the zealots rejoiced in the fact that the books were to be burned. But then when the Talmud was burned, not long thereafter, so then many of the rabbis said, you see that in heaven they voted for the Rambam. And in effect, once you start to burn books, so, you know, once you tell the church that it's the Jews are happy for you to burn their books, so then they burn other books too. Who's going to draw the line? A famous story about the great Rabbeinu Yonah Ibn Gerundi from Girona. So Rabbeinu Yonah originally was one of the strong opponents of the Rambam, and he was a gifted orator. He traveled to many towns and cities in northern Spain and southern France, Provence, and to speak against the Rambam's works. After the books of the Rambam were burned, and after the Talmud was burned, he regretted his behavior. He went back to every city that he spoke in, and he mounted the pulpit and said, I was wrong. I should never have done so. And as a further act of penance, he wrote what is one of the great books of Musar, philosophy, Jewish thought, called Shari Tshuva, the Gates of Repentance. So that whole incident in Jewish history, it's an incident that covers almost 150 years and involves a lot of great men. The Ramban, for instance, was the Rambam's great defender. The Ritvo was the Rambam's great defender. But there were great men on the other side, too. The Yad Ramah, Reb Meir HaLevi Avalafia, was a strong critic of the Rambam. The Rambam himself expected it to happen. He writes a letter in which he says that I have no doubt that all of this will be controversial and that people will call me all sorts of names, etc. But he said, when it all will settle down after a generation or two. He says it so strongly. He says when the jealousies and pettinesses will disappear, because they'll all be dead. So he said, then history will judge me, judge my works. And he certainly hit the nail on the head. And history is certainly voted for the Rambam. So we have this kina of Rav Meir of Rottenburg. It begins, Shali Srufo Boesh, you are burned in the fire. So many people think that it refers to the temple that was burned in the fire. He's not talking about the temple. That wasn't written. It was written about the Torah that was written, the books of the Balei Tosfos, all the scrolls of the Talmud that were burned. So you have a keynote for that also. In the Sephardic set of keynote, we have keynote for the expulsion from Spain, which probably until the Holocaust was the most traumatic event in the history of the Jewish people, the exile. The Jews were in Spain from the 600s, so they were there 800 years. Not only the Jews were there, they were the country. I mean, they were the commerce and the government and the poetry and the culture, everything. Couldn't think that there would be a Spain without Jews. And the Jews were Spanish to the core. You know, so if you live in a place for 800 years, you think you're going to live there forever, right? But apparently nothing is forever. Jews lived in Poland for 800 years also. That also didn't last. We were in North America about 150 years, so it's young yet. Even though the Jews in America are convinced that it's also forever. Since a call from the certain community, which I will not name, that they're celebrating their centennial, 100 years in the country. And they're having a big celebration. They invited me to come to be one of the speakers for their events. And then the man ruefully said, you better come this time because I don't know if 100 years from now there's going to be another one. So there is a certain sensation of the fact that it may not be forever. But the Jews were in Spain, it was going to be forever. And then they were driven out. So there, in the Sephardic keynote, that exists. We have, there was a great Spanish Jewish poet by the name of Rav Shlomo Ibn Gabiro. Shlomo Ibn Gabiro, so we have keynote from him, but the Sephardim had many from him. He was enormously prolific. He also wrote a great deal of secular poetry. He wrote a poem that's called Keter Malchut, the Crown of Royalty. The poem has 99 stanzas to it. It's magnificent in its praise of God. The entire poem is devoted to how a person should serve God. And the Sephardim read that poem on the night of Kol Nidre, as part of the service. It's like a little book. Moshe Rav Kook published it as a little book. It's just absolutely magnificent. And so he has kinos also. Sephardim have many more of his kinos in their liturgy than the Ashkenazim do, but we have also his poems in our keynote. And then we have the poems of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, whom I mentioned before. So his famous keynote begins, Tzion alo sishali l'shom asiraya. And that poem was so overwhelming in its beauty and so influential that it spawned the genre of poems that begin Tzion. And they all attempted to copy his meter and his rhyme and his style. But in terms of pure genius and poetry, we cannot find an equal to that poem of Tzion, of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. And there he has the famous phrase, Ani Chinor L'chol Shirayach, I am the harp upon which all of your songs can be played. And that was taken and inserted in the Hebrew song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, which was the song of the Six-Day War. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi longed his entire life to come to Zion, and he eventually forsook Spain and all of its wealth. He writes, Libi b'Mizrach, v'ani b'sof Marav. My heart is in the east, and I'm at the end all the way in the west of the Mediterranean. And he said, until my heart and I can come together, what kind of life can it be? And Rabbi HaLevi comes eventually to the land of Israel. He leaves his family, he leaves his wealth, his position, and he comes to the land of Israel. What happens to him here is unknown. There's a legend that he was killed at the gates of Jerusalem by an Arab horseman. It's a legend. We don't know what happened to him. We don't know where he's buried here. God does certain people a favor that he doesn't allow their burial place to be known. Moshe is a prime example of that. Because otherwise they'd be selling Coca-Cola there. Right? Souvenirs. You get a camel ride. And for a long time, the Jewish people weren't into graves. Today, graves is a big business. So where Yehuda HaLevi's grave is, where the Ramban's grave is in this country, no one knows. But he died here. And he became the symbol, not only because of his beautiful poetry, his talent, his creativity, but he also became the symbol of the Jewish longing for the land of Israel. That the Jews would never give up on their right to the land of Israel, and the fact that they would eventually gather the exiles and return to the land of Israel. They would rebuild themselves in the land of Israel. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi became, so to speak, our spokesman for that. The one that throughout the ages, his song, his poetry reverberated with that idea. And in this kina of Tzion Alo Sishali, so to speak, everything that can be said about Jewish revival in the land of Israel is said in that poem. Like when you're done with the poem, so there's nothing more to say. The vision is laid out beautifully, clearly, definitively. And therefore this poem was more than an elegy, it was an inspiration. And in the order of the keynote, therefore, they put it in the last third. It begins the last third of the recitation of the keynote, because at the end, so to speak, we're looking for an upbeat. Even the keynote, even Eicha is not allowed to end on a depressing note. So we repeat the posuk again, as we learned last week. Ashivenu Hashem Elecho v'noshuvoch adeish yomenu tikedem. God, bring us back again. So the kinos also don't end on a downbeat, but they end rather on a note of hope that the Jewish people, both individually and collectively, will yet be privileged to see better days. The form, the book of kinos as we have today, was pretty much sealed by the 15th century. So the later troubles are not reflected. We have no particular kino, for instance, for the disasters of 1648 and 1649, the pogroms in Eastern Europe, Kozak-Ukrainian rebellion, which cost hundreds of thousands of Jewish lives. In its time, it was the Holocaust. Relative to population, it was the ratio of the Holocaust. Almost. But we have no mention of it in the keynote. The rabbis made a special fast day in memory of it, the 20th day of Sivan. The 20th day of Sivan in the Middle Ages was a fast day over Jews in the city of Trier that were accused of the blood libel and of desecrating the host. All of the Christian accusations in the Middle Ages, and 13 Jews were slaughtered. So they, for 13 Jews, the rabbis declared a fast day. Today, 13 Jews is small change. There isn't even one bus. And the rabbis tacked on to the 20th of Sivan, therefore, the commemoration of the pogroms of Khmelnytsky, the Ukrainian rebellion, etc. But we have no kina for it. And except for people that read history books, it's unknown, even in the Torah one, which is really a sad note. There's no kina for the First World War, which also took at least 1 million Jewish lives. First of all, Jews fought on both sides in the armies. Jews fought in the Austrian, the Hungarian army, and the German army. And Jews fought in the French army, and in the Russian army, and the British army, and eventually in the army of the United States. But aside from that, you had a tremendous dislocation of the Jewish community in Eastern Europe, because the war was fought basically in Jewish territory. And so you had refugees, malnutrition, all the good things that come with war. And then to top it all off, then you had the Communist Revolution. So that was a tremendous disaster. But we have no kina for that either. Now regarding the Holocaust, the Shoah of the Second World War, so we have no official kina. But a number of kinot have been written. One was written by Rabbi Schwab of the German community in Washington Heights in New York. One was written by the Bobover Rebbe in Brooklyn. One was written by the Kloisenberger Rebbe here of Netanya. And there have been a number written by Israeli Rabbonim. And there are certain kihilot, there are certain congregations that recite these keynote regarding the Shoah. One of the great tragedies of the Shoah is the fact that we have found no effective way to commemorate it. In Jewish life, anything that is not connected with halakha becomes a sterile commemoration. It loses. We're able to commemorate our exodus from Egypt because we have a Seder. We have halakha, you know, and how to run it, and the mitzvot, and everything, so it's alive. But things that are not encompassed in halakha, that have no ritual, so to speak, so then it becomes very difficult to commemorate. So whether standing silent for a minute will preserve the memory of the Shoah, I have my doubts. Though I do stand silent when a siren rings. It's no more than courtesy. But whether that, or whether museums or anything else can do it, books, films, Schindler's List. Those are all attempts somehow to preserve the memory. But we see that memory fades. No shortage of Holocaust deniers. And there's no shortage of Holocaust forgetters. So the absence of, you know, an accepted official kina that would be read by the entire Jewish community and would become part of the book of kinah is certainly felt. That absence is a difficult, difficult thing to deal with because of the fact that therefore we, so to speak, abdicate the matter to all sorts of other commemorations, which may not stand the test of time. The Book of Kinot and the Sefer Eicha, the Megillah of Eicha, have withstood almost 2,000 years of time, which itself is a miracle. I don't know. It's part of the tragedy of the Holocaust is that there was no one left to mourn it. It was so enormous in its dimensions that no one could encompass it. And we will pay the price of the Holocaust for generations and generations because of what we are missing because those people were killed. So that somehow should also be involved in the Tisha B'Av mix of the troubles and travails of the Jewish people. But the keynote, the end on an optimistic note, as I mentioned before. We get up off the floor. And we say that there will be a better day. In our time, we have lived to see a better day. No one would have believed even 60 years ago that the Jewish world could look the way it looks today. That Torah could have been rebuilt as it has been rebuilt. That there could be a Jewish state. That there'd be 5.5 million Jews living in the land of Israel. That the Jewish community would be as influential and affluent as it is, thank God. So, it's not been without progress. But it's been a great cost, and a great sadness, and a great sacrifice. And Tisha B'Av encompasses within it all of those things. What was, what is, and what will be. And if we see it in that sense, so then the recitation of the keynote can have a relevance to us far greater than just memorializing what happened over 1900 years ago.
JM in the AM. Unbelievable insight from Rabbi Berlwein, especially as the Holocaust relates to or I should say that Tisha B'Av relates to modern-day catastrophes like the Holocaust as well. Unbelievable. 8:30 in the morning on this Erev Tisha B'Av, we will continue and conclude this morning's program with Rabbi Berlwein as he continues on Kinnis, Eicha and Kinnis from Sorrow to Hope. This is a lecture by Rabbi Berlwein from his series. You can get information at 1-800-499-WEIN. 1-800-499-WEIN or RabbiWein.com.
The kinnis for the night of Tisha B'Av are few in number because the main kinnis is the Megillah of Eicha itself. During the daytime, there is no requirement to read the Megillah of Eicha, but there is a custom that after kinnis, people gather together, Megillah of Eicha is read. But that's only a custom, whereas at night it's an obligation. So the main keynote of the night is Eicha itself, therefore there are very few keynotes afterwards. And so the first keynote, Zecho Hashem Me'ayolonu, follows the order of the Tzukim in Eicha. And what it does is acknowledges the sins of the Jewish people, which led to the Churban. Now, I want to see here at the fifth Kinos Hay, which is from Shlomo Ibn Gabiro, whom I mentioned yesterday. And this Kinos is built upon an imaginary dialogue between the northern kingdom, the ten tribes, and between the kingdom of Yehuda, the southern kingdom. Now, if you look at the Kinah, you will see how the rhyme is followed and the meter is followed. Now, the entire trick in poetry, in this type of poetry, is not to notice that the person is bound to the rhyme, and not to notice that he's bound to the meter. In other words, that it should not be stilted. And so here, the northern kingdom says that it was taken into captivity and has never returned. The ten tribes have been scattered. And to a great extent, the ten tribes have not survived as tribes. It says, Shnosai Orchu, Lo Orchu Shonai. Your years have been long, right? The exile of Judah has lasted for thousands of years, but the descendants are still here. But my years have not been long. Now, it touches upon the question of what happened to the ten tribes, which is really one of the great mysteries. Most of the commentators agree that somehow members of the ten tribes came south into Judah and assimilated with the rest of the Jews, so that there are Jews within the Jewish people today that are from every tribe. However, there's a romantic legend that exists in the Jewish world that the ten tribes were taken away into exile as a whole, and that they exist behind a river somewhere in the world. The river is called the Sambatyon, and that this is a magical river that is during the 6 days of the week, it spews sulfuric acid and bricks and fire so that no one can cross the river. And on Shabbat it rests. And because of that, therefore, the ten tribes never have a chance to come, because of the fact that the river blocks them. And this legend took hold within the Jewish people, so especially at a time when there were uncharted places in the world. And it would be possible to believe that there are corners of the world where people are hidden away. And during the Middle Ages, there were people who came and said that they were representatives of the ten tribes. They somehow escaped, and they came to... one was a man called Eldad Hadoni. Eldad from the tribe of Don. So he's quoted Lahalocha. He lived in the 9th century. He's quoted in Halocha. The Rosh quotes him, others quote him. Enigmatic, mysterious figure. The second one, the most famous one, is a man called David Haruveni, who came in the end of the 15th and the beginning of the 16th centuries to Europe, and he claimed that he was an emissary of the tribe of Reuven and from the Jewish kingdom of the ten tribes, and he came with all sorts of documents, diplomatic documents. And in that world, he was accepted. He was accepted not only by the Jews, he was accepted by the non-Jews. He had an audience with the Pope, all the kings of Europe, and he inspired messianic ideas within the Jewish people. But finally he was arrested by one of the kings in Central Europe, and he died in prison. But that was a famous incident, David HaRuvein. So we don't know what happened to the 10 tribes. It's interesting that in the world, everybody wants to be Jewish but the Jews. So the English claim that they're descended from the 10 tribes. The Japanese say they're descended from the 10 tribes. Everybody wants to be descended from the 10 tribes. So this is the conversation that Reb Shlomo Ibn Gabirol puts in the mouth of the 10 tribes speaking to the tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. And that basically is the order of the kinos for the night time. Now the Kriyas HaTorah for Tisha B'Av is taken from this week's Parsha, from the Parsha of Eschanon, where Moshe tells the Jewish people that if you stray away from God, you will have consequences that follow you. And that's the Parsha that's read for the Kriyas HaTorah. The Haftorah is taken from the Novi Yirmiyah. The Haftorah is sung to the melody of Eicha, and it's really an elegy on what happened to the Jewish people, even though the Novi is saying it out of prophecy. It hasn't happened yet, but he speaks of it as reality. At the end of the Haftorah, there are two famous psukim that I'd like to spend a moment on. Ko'amar Hashem, thus says God, Al Yishalel Chochom B'Chochmoso, let not the wise man praise himself because of his wisdom. Al Yishalel Agibor B'Guraso, and let not the strong man praise himself because of his strength. Al Yishalel Oshir B'Oshro, and let not the wealthy man praise himself because of his wealth. So the Mefarshim say that the Navi here is talking not only about physical wealth and strength and wisdom, he's talking about the definitions that Chazal gave to these concepts. The Gemara says, Ezeu Chocham, who is a Chocham? The Gemara says, Aroas Anola, someone that sees the future, that has vision, that's a Chocham. The Gemara says, Ezeu Oshir, who's a wealthy man, Asameach Bechelko, someone that can be satisfied with what he has. The Gemara says, who's a Gibor? A strong man, Zeakovish Yitzro, who's able to control his desires, is able to discipline himself. So the Novi says, even if you're that kind of a Chochem, even if you're a person with great vision, with holy vision, and even if you're a person that you can control your desires, and even if you're a person that's satisfied with what you have, don't praise yourself yet, because that's still not the goal. That's not what we're aiming for. Ki bezos yishalel hamishalel. This is what a person should praise himself. Haskel v'yadoa osi. Understand me. Understand what I want. To see the forest and not just the trees. Ki ani Hashem oseh chesed. I am the Lord that performs chesed, goodness, mishpat, justice, tzedaka, righteousness, ba'aretz. So those are the fundamental principles that we see throughout the Tanakh that the prophets spoke about. That there has to be a society of goodness. People have to be nice one to another. And chesed is not just giving money. the chesed is giving the smile, soft word, saying good morning. Mishpat has to be a just society, not a corrupt society. Be an element of rectitude to it. Tzedakah is righteousness. Righteousness basically means that there are certain absolute standards. Certain things are right and certain things are wrong. These are the things that I want, God says. So that's the goal. That's what Tisha B'Av is supposed to bring us to. To understand what God wants from us. So many times in life, one of my favorite phrases is that, you know, people just don't get it. They don't understand. And when you don't get it, so then it's hard to achieve this goal. I have a story that that always illustrates it to me. I have a friend of mine, older than I am, that he fought in the American Army in the Second World War, and the rotation method then in the Army is not the way it is today, that they rotate veteran soldiers out and put in fresh soldiers. But there you stayed in the front lines until you got killed or the war ended. So 80% of the soldiers that landed at D-Day never survived to the end of the war. Because the statistics are against you. In any event, he fought through Europe, he landed on Normandy, on D-Day, fought through the entire way into Germany, the last days of the war. The last days of the war, Hitler had old men and young boys fighting. Now, the young boys were fanatical. They were Hitler youth. They were the suicide bombers of their day. And an 11-year-old with a rifle can also kill you. So he told me that he and his friend, his buddy, were hiding behind the wall of a farmhouse, and they were pinned down by fire from these kids. And he said that he was overcome by a tremendous sense of hunger. So he reached down in his boot to take out the candy bar that he had, part of the American rations, give a person instant sugar. And he bent down, a bullet shot over his head and killed his buddies next to him. So he came to a yeshiva in Chicago 50 years after D-Day. They asked him to speak about his experiences, etc. And he told that story of how in war one realizes that there's a personal God, that there's Hashgacha Pratis. He told that story. Someone raised his hand and asked him, was the candy bar kosher? So that's when you don't get it. I had that experience yesterday. I had a meeting with Yosef Mendelovich, who was one of the great prisoners of Zion, and who spent 11 years in the Gulag, a great tzaddik. I mean, he's just an unbelievable personality. Great Jew. And he was one of in a group of people that attempted to hijack a plane from Leningrad, have it fly to the west because they wanted to come out of Russia into Israel. He wrote a book about it called Mifza Chatuna, Operation Wedding. That's what they call the plan. And the book is going to be translated into English now if it's in Hebrew. It's just remarkable, the book, and the person is remarkable. So he said that he went to a certain yeshiva also in the United States, and he was asked to speak about his experiences, and he spoke about his experiences and the gulag and everything. And so when it was over, one of the students asked, he said that, did you consult with the Gedolim before you attempted to escape? So, again, you don't get it, you don't get it. So the Navi wants us to get it. That's basically what the Haftorah is about. That's really what Tisha B'Av is about, to get it. Haskel v'yadoa osi, to know me, to deal with me. So to deal with God, one needs a certain breadth of vision. One has to see the past, the present, the future. One has to see one's role. A lot of factors that enter into Haskel v'yadoa osi. But that's what the Navi wishes for us. That's what he demands for us. Alright, now the kinos of the day, which are many in number. There are 40 kinos. So as I mentioned, over half of them are from Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. And Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, the first 21 of the kinos are all Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. And they are difficult Hebrew. And they make reference to many midrashim and many things that are written in the Talmud. And so therefore, it's not only something to be recited, it is something to be studied. Again, you will notice that he maintains the rhyme and he also maintains the meter. And that's the greatness of the poetry. And his thing is always based on Eicha, on the Psukim of Eicha. In most of the poetry, he has an acrostic hidden, which spells his name, Elazar Barabi Kalir. But in Chof Beis, in the 22nd Kina, we have the mayor of Rottenburg, and this kina refers to the Asara Haruge Malchus, 10 martyrs that were killed by the Romans. And this, we have a similar poem that we recite Yom Kippur for Mincha, or in some communities it's recited in the Musaf. Service of Yom Kippur, which records the martyrdom of the 10 great men that are mentioned in the Talmud, the martyrdom at the hands of the Romans. Now, it did not happen in one day. In fact, the 10 men are not even contemporaries. It's over the period of almost a century. But in the poems, it's like all lumped together, as though it was all in one day. And among them, naturally, is the story of Rabbi Akiva, whose skin was flayed. He was tortured to death. So he was killed in Caesarea. And according to Jewish tradition, his body was taken to be buried in Tiberias, where the cave is shown today as being his burial place. Now, also, according to Jewish tradition, he was killed Erev Yom Kippur. And we remember Rabbi Akiva in the opening prayers on the night of Yom Kippur, because we say the verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, Or Zorua Latzadik Uli Yishrei Leib Simcha. There is a light that extends for the righteous one, And for those who have a straight, correct heart, there will yet be joy. So that pasuk refers to Rabbi Akiva. And how do we know it refers to Rabbi Akiva? Because his name is spelled in an acrostic of the last letters of the words of the pasuk. Or is Reish, that's Rabbi. Zeruah is Ayin. Latsadik is Kuf. The Yishrei is Yud. Lev is Beis. Simcha is Hey. So that spells Ayin, Kuf, Yud, Beis, Hey. Is that Akiva? There's a discussion in Halacha whether Akiva is a Jewish name, a Hebrew name, or it's a non-Hebrew name. The rule is, my friends, that if it's a Hebrew name and it ends with that sound, then it's always a hey is the final. Like Sarah, Rivka, Yonah, Micha, they're all spelled with a hey. But if it's an Aramaic name or a non-Hebrew name, then it ends with an aleph. Abba, Acha, all of those names all end with an aleph. Now in our Gemara, in the printed Gemara, Akiva is always spelled with an aleph, as though it were not a Hebrew name. But the Or Zeruah, who lived in the 14th century in Bohemia, so he says that Akiva is really a Hebrew name and it should always be spelled with a hey. So there are Akivas in the world that spell it with a A, and there are those that spell it with an aleph. You'll say, what's the difference? The difference is, practical difference in halacha is, that if there's a divorce, how do we spell the name? Because the rules regarding names in a divorce are enormously strict. So we usually leave it up to how the person himself spelled the name. But here we have the martyrdom of Rabbi Akiva, and then we have the martyrdom of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bova was the one that saved the Torah by giving smicha to the five Talmidim, to Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, and Nosson, Shimon. And then we have Rabbi Hananya ben Trajon, who was burned with the Sefer Torah. And there we have the famous Gemara that he said that parchment burns, but the letters fly in the air.
I believe we will start with this lecture tomorrow morning on Tisha B'Av morning here at JM and the AM, the second half of the Kinnis overview by Rabbi Beryl Wein. Before our own Kinnis service tomorrow morning right here at JMAM.